Now, I have been diverting a little bit from the early church history to simply make a point. We've skipped ahead to the 16th and 17th centuries, particularly the opening of the 17th century. Reading from a little book by Alexander McClure, Translators Revived, a biographical notes of the King James Version Bible translators. The point I'm making is so obvious it's almost a put down to say it to those that have been listening, so let me say it to those that haven't been. There is an overexposure of ignorance among television preachers today that endangers the species called the saints because they claim to be their representatives. They are not their aberrations. They are not the true representatives of Christianity down through the ages. And I am tired of the impression being garnered that you need to be a retard or a jerk in order to qualify for the ministry. I see them waving the King James around. You know, that would be like having some graffiti artist claim to be the producer of a Van Gogh. If I listen to Jimmy Swaggart, you'd think that God has anointed him to be the sole protector of the King James Version of the Bible, while he dumps insults on the kinds of people that produced it. So my little excursion down this biographical lane is simply to show you, by looking at these King James Version Bible translators, that the church has not been as poverty-stricken for men and women of quality as it appears to be today. The church is getting on the defensive, and I've even been sucked in because of the principles involved to appearing to defend some real jerks. The more I study this Jim Baker thing, and the more I preach the reality of grace and peace, the more I have to resist the temptation to argue with God that grace and peace has to be available to such jerks in order to include the rest of us. It's like my arguments on constitutional freedom. The price of freedom is association with nuts. Individuality in religion that brings forth the best also brings forth the worst. Still think Jim Baker's a coward. A user. A self-pitying little jerk. I have no sympathy for him. I think Jerry Falwell's a pompous ass. I think Jimmy Swaggart's an unadulterated dope who thinks he's a messiah. My view is, if you were in quicksand, it'd be better to go down than to have him deliver you. I have no use for any of these jerks. The more I analyze them, the less sympathy I have for any of them. Jim Baker created his own mess. Why should we sympathize with him? I am concerned that we don't give away the principles of Christianity in the process. I think over the years, the number of times that I offered help to that jerk, and when he had nowhere else to turn but to me, he'd take the help. But as soon as he thought he had an air hole elsewhere, he'd revert to type. Why should I feel sorry for those jerks? I used to preach in camps where Jimmy Swaggart preached. I'd come one year and try to clean up what he ruined the previous year. I still remember having to kick Jim Baker off of our network, ultimately, and try to get him to keep a commitment he had made, which he didn't keep. I had a wife for 23 years. I got rid of her. I remember Jim saying in public, not too long back, that if he had to choose between his family and his ministry, he'd choose his family. Well, he's got his family now in his little isolation hovel in Palm Springs and doesn't have his ministry. So he got what he wanted. So why should we feel sorry for the jerk? Now, it's very easy when you watch two people so ugly you want to vomit going at it. When one of them gets battered sufficiently that you can't see their true nature, you can feel sorry for them long enough because you still see the other one's ugliness. But when the dust settles, they're both ugly. I'm trying to point out to you that Christianity has enjoyed better. And what a tragedy that Christianity in this generation, as we approach the last days when the responsibility of the church is the highest, has to be on trial clear across the board because of these stupid jerks. And that all Christians have to come under attack from a ruthless media because of these stupid jerks. I hate shepherds that abandon their flocks. I hate shepherds that steal other people's flocks. And no good in any of them. And the sooner they kill one another off and free the airwaves for some decent ministry, the better the whole world is going to be. All we have to worry about is that the principles that are dear and affect every Christian are not lost in the process. And that's what I'm trying to rescue. Francis Dillingham. We're looking at some of those that were chosen for the second phase. The Committee of Ten, headed by Lancelot Andrews, took the translation of the King James up through the Kings. First books of the Bible and up through the Kings. And we've seen they were a no-piker bunch. There wasn't a piker in the midst. Then there was a second committee that ended. The first committee ended with William Bedwell. The second committee took up where the first committee left off. The first committee ending with the second book of Kings and with Mr. Bedwell. The second company of the King James translators held its meetings in Cambridge. The other group was the Westminster Company. To this section was assigned from the beginning of Chronicles to the end of the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. 8 men had this part of the scripture assigned to them, and they were not one whit behind their associates, as we have seen, for we looked at Edward Lively, John Richardson, Lawrence Chatterton, every one of them amazing in their ability, none of them poor. And we are still dealing with this second committee, and I'm at a half-hour break. Now, I'm not going to read about all of these people. I'm going to be selective after I go through a few more of them. But I think you're starting to get the flavor of the kind of people that translated the King James Version of the Bible. There weren't a bunch of jerks. Translators Revived, Biographical Notes of the King James Version Translators by Alexander McClure. There were 2 committees that we have gotten to thus far. There were more than that. The first committee of 10 took the Old Testament from Genesis through the Kings. They were the Westminster Committee. The second committee of 8 took it from Chronicles through the Song of Solomon. They met at Cambridge. These are some of the quality people that did that. Francis Dillingham, he was a fellow of Christ College, Cambridge. After the translation was finished, he became the parson of Dean, his native place in Bedfordshire. He also obtained the rich benefice of Wildon in the same county, where he died a single and wealthy man. My father, says worthy old Thomas Fuller, was present in the bachelor school when a Greek act was kept. That is, a debate carried on in the Greek tongue. I want to make sure that I clean that up. I wanted to make sure that you know that this was something that television evangelists couldn't do. A debate carried on in the Greek tongue. Francis Dillingham on the Cambridge Committee that translated the section of the King James from the Chronicles through Song of Solomon. A fellow of Christ College, Cambridge. He obtained the rich benefice of Wildon in the same county where he died a single and wealthy man after having become parson of Dean, his native place in Bedfordshire. My father, says worthy old Thomas Fuller, was present at the bachelor's school when a Greek act was kept between Francis Dillingham and William Alabaster to their mutual commendation. The Greek act was a debate carried on in the Greek tongue. Now, we've had our fun, but I want you to stop now and zero in seriously on the possibility of Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Falwell and Jim Baker carrying on their debate in the Greek language. Now, after all, that's the language that the Old Testament being used by Jesus and Paul was written in the Septuagint. After all, that was the language of the New Testament. It's rather pathetic that these great defenders of the book can't even read it in its original language. You see, I'm just frankly fed up with people placing a premium on ignorance and then calling it Christianity. Are you putting down those that don't have education? No. I believe there's a difference between schooling and learning. We're talking about intelligence. Lancelot Andrews didn't get his language skills by formal training per se. He took a vacation once a month, went to visit his parents, and found a private tutor who would teach him a language in a month. I don't think everybody has to have these skills. I don't even quarrel with Jimmy Swaggart. Jimmy Swaggart, when he sang, I thought he was a good singer. When he sang and when he preached a simple gospel message with humility and love and told the good news, because I do believe that God called him to be an evangelist. I don't quarrel with Oral Roberts. Healed from his physical condition and preaching the good news of salvation and laying hands on the sick and praying for them, that never bothered me. I don't care how rich he gets. What I object to is when a man like Jimmy Swaggart builds a school, starts teaching, and sets himself up as an authority trying to explain words he can't pronounce. And setting himself up as an authority to put down the rest of the world, belittle education, belittle the professors, say, kick them out. You know, it smells of the kinds of things that you see throughout history when ignorant people who resent what they don't have a chance to tear down a museum or a library and burn its contents. You always wonder why that the rabble-rousing mob gets its kicks by tearing art objects down and burning books and removing that which is a threat to their newly obtained dominance. This is not what the church was supposed to be. And I've just simply had it. You know, people say, well, look who Jesus chose, fishermen and yeah, look what a bunch of nuts they were. The issue of Jesus' choice of disciples was that it's always been that his demand for commitment is such that only the have-nots seem willing to do it. Jesus was sorrowful when the rich young ruler went away from him. And after his ministry was completed, Jesus had a miserable bunch that were following him. They denied him and fled when he needed them the most. And within a few short months after his resurrection, they were already aborting the gospel and making it a splinter group of legalism within the Judaistic frame of the church. God had to reach outside the church and get one man that could stand up to all of them, whose learning and abilities were second to none. And without Paul, the work of Christ would have been aborted and died. It wasn't one of those slaves, critical of everybody, including Moses when he tried to defend them. He's criticized by his fellow Hebrew. It wasn't one of those that delivered children of Israel out of Egypt. God's all powerful. if he wanted to place a premium on ignorance, why didn't he float Moses into some tanner's house? Why didn't he float Moses into some seamstress's house? Why did he float Moses into the house of the king, where he could be learned in all the wisdom of Egypt, which was above that of any nation in the world at the time, to help get him ready for the job he would do of shaping this nation as he led him through the wilderness? God has not placed a premium on ignorance. Now, I can't sit silent and let these jerks typify leadership in Christianity. And I can no longer stand the mutuality of disrespect that is spewed from the world because they are acting like these jerks are the true representatives of Christianity. They aren't. My father, says worthy old Thomas Fuller, was present in the bachelor school when a Greek act, which is a debate carried on in the Greek tongue, was kept between Francis Dillingham and William Alabaster to their mutual commendation. The point I'm seeing here is that they sharpened their skills in this language so necessary for understanding God's book, and which they were chosen as translators and thus would use to the maximum. They sharpen their skills like an athlete. There's nothing that tests the ability in the language like carrying on a debate. And instead of carrying on the debate in their natural tongue, they debated in the Greek. They didn't debate about the Greek. They carried on a debate about some subject, but limited their language used in the debate to the Greek tongue. That skill, man, and that dedication to polishing that skill. It was a disputation so famous that it served for an era or epoch for the scholars in that age. From this, it would seem that he was not without reason styled the great Grecian. Dillingham was noted as an excellent linguist and a subtle disputant, and was author of various theological treatises. Francis Dillingham was a diligent writer, both of practical and polemic divinity. He collected out of Cardinal Bellarmine's writings all the concessions made by that acute author in favor of Protestantism. He published a manual of the Christian faith taken from the fathers and a variety of treatises on different points belonging to the Roman controversy. They weren't a bunch of dummies. They had their weaknesses. They weren't above letting their personal biases show through. They had their own theological prejudices, but they weren't a bunch of peanut brains. Roger Andrews, still on the committee, second committee, who had been fellow in Pembroke Hall, was Master of Jesus College, Cambridge. He also became prebendary of Chichester and Southwell. He, too, was a famous linguist in his time, like his brother Lancelot. We've already looked at Lancelot Andrews. His brother, Roger Andrews, was on the second committee, equal in ability to Lancelot. Thomas Harrison. He had been a student and fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, and was now vice master of that important seminary. Thomas Fuller records the following instance of his charity. I remember when the Reverend Vice Master of Trinity College in Cambridge was told that one of the scholars had abused him in an oration. Did he, said he, name me? Did he name Thomas Harrison? And when it was returned that he named him not, then said he, I do not believe that he meant me. This smiling broadly. We have a strong evidence of his reputation. See, these people weren't pompous asses all the time, having to show forth their holiness, unable to engage in a little bit of subtle humor. I still like Lancelot Andrews' answer to King James about his ability to take money without having to bother with Parliament. Take it from Brother Neil, because he volunteered it. These were intelligent and still human individuals. We have a strong evidence, Thomas Harrison, of his reputation in the university and another duty which was assigned him. On account of his exquisite skill in the Hebrew and Greek idioms, not just the language, but his specialty skill in the Hebrew and Greek idioms, he was one of the chief examiners in the university of those who sought to be public professors of these languages. He didn't just examine students of Greek. He was the chief examiner of those who would be public professors of Greek. Now, can you see a gathering of all these that we've read about? They gather for tea. At Jimmy Swaggart's nouveau riche attempt to copy Beverly Hills in Baton Rouge with his gold fixtures on his bathroom facilities, and they gather for tea. Jimmy sings a song to them. Falwell defines righteousness. Falwell. And Jim Baker gives a lecture on family relations. And all of these divines leave richly rewarded at having been taught by these three leaders of the Christian church. I can hear their discussions as they fly back to England on how richly rewarded they were to have made this trip to expand their understanding of the Christian faith and sit at the feet of the masters, Jerry Faultwell, Jimmy Swaggaround, and Jimmy the Little. The teachers of the Christian faith in the 20th century, they get in their time machine and can go back to the 17th century and really teach with effectiveness now. They've sat at the feet of Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, and Jimmy the Little. Go ahead and puke. And we allow the news media to put the Church of Jesus Christ on the defensive because of these jerks? I think that the Church would be greatly saved and served if there was a way in which Christian peoples could pay each of them a golden parachute of $10 million apiece if they would go forever into exile and never be heard from again. It'd be the cheapest investment the Church of Jesus Christ could make. And then in floats Shuler for the benediction.
This is the end of side one. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.